Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week we bring you another episode of the Delaware Humanities Podcast, A More Just Delaware. The podcast examines pivotal moments in legislation related to hate, prejudice, and the fight for equal rights in Delaware. In this second episode, we focus on the landmark Brown v. Board of Education U.S. Supreme Court decision that ended racial segregation in public schools. We'll discuss the two Delaware cases involved in Brown and look at how using the courts to advance the cause of integrating schools and delivering equity in education continues. The podcast features historian, writer, and Black history educator Kathy Trusty. She is owner of Black History EdZone, a company that produces Black history products to facilitate the inclusion of Black history in the classroom, and she is the author of multiple Black history children's books. Here is the latest episode of the A More Just Delaware podcast. So let's start specifically with Brown versus Board of Education. I think in recent years, we have seen more discussion locally of the two Delaware cases that were part of Brown. Can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of those two cases and how they fit into the Brown decision and its legacy?
Okay, the first case was Belton v. Gephardt. There were 12 students who lived in Claymont, Delaware. And they had to travel down to the all-Black high school in Wilmington to attend classes. And it became a bit of a struggle. It took a long time. I read somewhere at that time it took maybe an hour one way. And if you were involved in extracurricular activities, then that just added more to your day problems getting home. So parents in Claymont, Delaware, parents of the 12 students, sued the Board of Education to have their kids attend that school. And they were denied admission. The other case, Bueller v. Gephardt, Shirley Bueller was a six-year-old little girl. She had to travel. She attended the colored school. It was 107C, the colored school in Hokesson. And every day, a school bus passed carrying white kids would pass her, taking those kids to school. But little Shirley had no transportation. Her parents would have to stop whatever they were doing for that day, drive her to school, and then go later on and pick her up. At one point, the mother did stop the bus driver to see if he would just carry her daughter some of the way to her school. Apparently her school was closer to the white school than her home. So wherever he would drop her off, she would be able to walk on her own to her school. And the bus driver said he couldn't do that. It wasn't that he did not, my understanding is not that he didn't want to do that, but he didn't have the authority to say, I'll take your child. And he actually suggested that she write a letter asking for transportation. And there's a letter that her parents wrote to the governor, I believe it was Governor Carvel at the time, asking for transportation. And they decided that they could not, they did not provide transportation for Black, or as they were called, colored at that time. So Shirley's parents decided to approach Lewis Redden, who was the first and only Black attorney in Delaware at that time. And the parents approached him because they simply wanted a bus to take their daughter to her own school. But Redden wasn't interested in that. He said he did not want to help them get their child to a segregated school. So he said, if you want to sue so your child could attend the white school, he would do that. And they agreed. And he was already representing the Belton, the students in the Belton lawsuit. So he combined the two cases, and that's how they became Belton Bueller v. Gephardt.
I was going to say, so really Lewis Redden recognized the possibility of these two cases, particularly combined, having a real impact and being something that could set the standard for attacking the segregation of public schools in the nation.
Absolutely, yes. And he worked with, he was with the team of, just some background, there was a team of NAACP attorneys, brilliant attorneys, who were working on different cases. So Jack Greenberg, who was with the NAACP at the time, he and Lewis Redden filed the Belton Bueller cases in Chancery Court in here in Delaware, and the judge was Collins, Judge Collins Sykes, and he ruled in favor of the plaintiff. He actually visited the school that the high school students in Claymont were attending. He determined that it was inferior. I'm not sure if he visited the other school, but he did rule in favor of both of them, and he said that those 12 students should be allowed to attend Claymont High, and that little Shirley Bueller should be able to attend the white school and be on the bus in her neighborhood. But the problem with his ruling, even though he ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, it was not statewide. It only applied to those two cases. And the biggest problem with the attorney was that it did not end separate but equal. Collins Sykes felt that that was a decision of that was up to the Supreme Court. And because both sides appealed the case, the Attorney General appealed because they lost, and Redding and Greenberg appealed because they really wanted to strike down separate but equal in Delaware. And that's how they all, and as you know, all those cases went to the Supreme Court and they were combined there under Brown v. Board of Education.
So, of course, those cases wound up being essentially settled as part of the overall Brown decision. Can you tell us a little bit about the impact the Brown decision had in Delaware because of these two Gebhardt cases? And was the fact that Delaware had these specific cases involved, does that make kind of the impact or implementation of Brown a little bit different here than maybe elsewhere in the country?
To be honest with you, in all my research, the main impact of Brown was it set the legal it set the it established a legal principle. It ended separate but equal. But the Brown decision did not come with any type of enforcement. So the enforcement was really at the local level. And also, since Collins Sykes had already ruled in favor of in 1952 of the Bueller and Belton, they both applied. I mean, those plaintiffs applied to those schools in September of 52, and they were accepted. Belton, the named plaintiff of the 12 students, she actually ended up staying at Howard High because by that time her family had moved. Nothing else really happened. Shirley Bueller went to the all-white school in Hillcrest, and she was well accepted. She stayed there for about 3 years. And it took some time for other students to eventually apply and begin attending these schools. So as I said, most of what happened after the Brown ruling was a result of local actions rather than the Brown case itself.
And because of that, I mean, there obviously progress still remains in many cases somewhat slow in
Yes.
really truly desegregating schools both here and elsewhere. And I guess that wound up being the reason why there was further efforts to use the courts to move things along using the Brown precedent, but having to almost kind of piecemeal, case by case, move things forward.
Absolutely. And also, when the judges decided, the Supreme Court justices decided the Brown case, they did wonder, like, how was this going to be implemented? But Thurgood Marshall said no, he was worried about the legal principle. He would take care of it at the local level, and that's how other cases would come up. But they had the legal principle, the precedent had been set, so that was how they were able to win the cases at the local level. And as you know, probably know, a year later there was a second Brown decision because things weren't moving along. And in May of 1955, there was a second ruling, and the judges ruled that schools need to start desegregating and at all deliberate speed, but no one knew what that meant. And Thurgood Marshall, I don't know if he was joking or what, he said that really just means slow. So there was no enforcement behind anything, but all everything really took place at the local level.
And looking at that happening at the local level, we certainly saw that play out in Delaware in terms of busing. And we saw that obviously take place a lot of places, but certainly Delaware had its own history with busing to desegregate schools in 1978.
Right.
New Castle County was ordered to use busing to integrate schools, sending city students to suburban schools, suburban students to city schools, to achieve racial integration. Obviously, that was a fraught process. It saw pushback from parents whose kids were in the city going to the suburbs and vice versa. But I guess the point I want to get to is, I guess ultimately, as we saw busing play out, studies showed it seemed to have the desired effect on the numbers. It created racial balance numerically. But many
It
wound
did.
up arguing that it didn't do so in terms of actual equity, in terms of discipline, the actual education students got. And I guess I want to ask this question: is the busing writ large kind of an example of the limitation that courts can have in advancing equity in education, that they can get the numbers right, but maybe they're not getting the actual equity right?
I agree with that. They can, you're right, they can get the numbers right. But it wasn't just busing. Because of busing, for 10 years, maybe 12 years, Delaware had one of the most desegregated school districts in the country. Kentucky was the other state. And that was just, like you said, a numbers game. It was mainly because of busing. But they didn't take in almost all decisions and all laws that were passed. I think the intent was good, but I don't think they ever looked at the family dynamic just to see how things would affect the kids and the parents of these kids. So yes, you were absolutely right. It was more like a numbers game, but not much else.
Because it strikes me when we talked about the case involving the Belton case involving the kids in Claymont, part of the argument even you were mentioning was the fact that these kids had to go into the city. If they're in extracurricular activities or parents wanted to be involved in something in the school, that would, the distance made a difference. And in some
Right.
ways, busing did the same thing. You took
Right.
kids from the city and put them out in the suburbs and made everything harder for their families. There is kind of a weird irony to that, right?
I know, I totally agree. And with busing, it was weird. And I still don't understand this. I think when they did start busing, it was the kids would go to I'm just gonna call them white and black schools for 9 years, and then the other school for 3 years.
Right.
I cannot get a good read on that, and I'm not sure what they were trying to accomplish with that, except to say we're complying with the Brown v. Board of Education decision. But other than that still has me a little bit baffled.
It certainly was a process, and it's the process that we even hear discussion today about. I mean, even in his last presidential campaign, current President Joe Biden, Kamala Harris in a debate stage, bring up that issue where Joe Biden's
Yes.
trying to explain, his position on busing, and even those explanations tend to be like, well, I'm for this, but I'm against the way it's happening. And I guess in a lot of ways, that's the problem with these court-ordered solutions, is that it really is, as even you were saying, hard to kind of get your head around exactly what's happening
Right.
and the impact.
No, absolutely. And not just the court decisions, other laws that were passed is like the intent is always good. But as I said, I don't think they look at the full picture, the family, the income of the family, the family dynamic, whether or not the family had cars, like you said, to get back and forth to activities, extracurricular activities. They didn't look at any of that. I like I said, I do think the intent was good, but I don't know that enough effort was put into how is this all going to play out
Well,
for the benefit of the kids.
ultimately, the busing order was lifted here in Delaware in the mid-1990s. And shortly after that, speaking of laws by lawmakers, state lawmakers passed a series of laws: Charter School Act in 95, School Choice Act in 1996, Neighborhood Schools Act in 2000. And many have argued that these laws have essentially led to kind of a resegregation of schools. Arguing that while the Neighborhood Schools Act mandated that, barring exceptional circumstances, districts assign schools to the public schools closest to their homes, that's to address
Right.
the issues we're talking about in terms of having family involvement and making life easier on families. While that was true of that law, the charter and choice laws often allowed students assigned to majority black schools in Wilmington to enroll in mostly white schools in the suburbs.
Right. Right.
Is that something that you think about as well, that there is kind of been almost a pendulum shift back to a resegregation because of these laws like charter school laws and school choice laws?
Absolutely. I always say that the Brown's legacy has not been fulfilled because of those laws. The ruling schools should desegregate, but because of other things that took place, I always say the schools are integrated, but they are not desegregated, meaning that segregation is illegal, so they're not intentionally segregating students, but the laws are actually unintentionally segregating, making segregation possible in the schools now. So, I look at that a lot and I think about that a lot.
And I guess the issue with this is that because it's kind of a different style of segregation, it may be harder to have a court rule to untangle this problem. Where Brown, it was very you should say it was very easy, but Brown was very clear. There was
Right.
it was a precedent of separate but equal. It overturned that. In these cases, it's a lot more, I guess, subtle. And I guess that makes it a little bit more difficult for a court to untangle.
I totally agree, and I wonder if when Thurgood Marshall, when the Justice Supreme Court justices said that they did not know how they would implement, enforce the decision. I think maybe Thurgood Marshall thought maybe he did think at the local level they would be able to change a lot of things. But a lot of what happened with Brown happened also, I think not more, more was not done at the local level because I've heard someone call the Brown lawyers a dream team of lawyers. But what happened later on, so many of those lawyers, because of their brilliance, they all became judges. Thurgood Marshall became Solicitor General and then Supreme Court Justice. A bunch of them became lawyers. So that dream team of lawyers kind of disappeared. So I don't know if, and because the case was already settled, they'd won Brown, segregation was illegal. I don't know that other lawyers saw the need to, to pick that up again, to fight harder at the local level to make sure that things were implemented. So I just don't know, what can be done about that even today.
Well, I guess the one thing we've seen locally in the courts is the recent case here in Delaware on education funding equity. The settlement of that case in 2020 has led to more state funding for education aimed at low-income children, English language learners, students in kindergarten through third that have special needs. It also led to property reassessments for the first time in decades that are actually happening now in an effort to get the funding right on education. And I guess most recently, as part of that lawsuit, there was a report on education funding in the state that called for more spending and changes to the funding formula. And I guess piggybacking what we're just talking about, is this kind of the next step is to find the other pieces of equity and go to the courts and try to solve that. In this case, looking at the funding piece of it, okay, we have integrated schools, but what we need is we need the funding to make sure the schools that need the most get what it needs.
Yeah, that needs to happen. But I don't think that's ever going to happen. For whatever reason, things tend to stop short. They know where the needs are, but I think the problem is putting things into place in action. Another thing that I often think about is HB 198, the Black History in schools. That's a great idea. It should be taught throughout the school year. But the problem is, because it hadn't been taught in the past, who's qualified to teach it now and what should be taught? So yeah, I mean those law you know the lot of things are people are trying to do a lot of things to to make all this work, but it tend to fall short. And it's funny that you mentioned the property value. I think early on, years ago, when they did the busing, I think Judge Schwartz actually talked about property value and what would happen with that. So that's not new. That started they started talking about that years ago.
And it does feel like that's really that there's two issues here. One is like there's the kind of what I generally call like the devil in the details piece of it. It's like how do you
Right.
actually make it work? And then the other is the will, right? The will for people to do the things that they've been asked to do, whether it be including Black history education in school curriculum or doing the things in terms of education funding that need to be done. Is that ultimately what it comes down to? Is that the courts can say whatever they want to say, but if people don't have the will to do it, as you said, it's going to fall short.
Right, absolutely. A couple of days ago, I just happened to go online, you know, with the school choice. There are schools where you can apply to go to any school, I guess within your district or whatever. So when I looked online, a lot of it, a lot, there was a waiting list. So I was thinking about the parent. I sit at a computer all day, so I can always check a computer, see where I, if I had a child, see where I could get that child. If I'm looking at a parent who's working in a restaurant, they don't have access to that, so they miss out on a lot of things. So a lot, like a lot of those laws, the intent was really good, but nothing is really done to help people navigate the system. The same thing with charter schools and all of that. There's a whole application process. Not enough done is enough. Enough is done to help parents get to where they need to get their kids to. The laws are there and they sound good. The intent is really good. I believe that the intent is good, but nothing is done to help parents get their students there, and which I believe is a real problem.
Are there some other areas that you feel are examples of equity issues that need to be addressed more and maybe a way that the courts can or lawmakers can move it along in a better way? Or is it really we are at that point where it's a matter of will and people, you know, making the effort to do what the laws are asking them to do?
I think at this point it's a matter of wills. If you of will, if you look at the laws on the books, they have some pretty good laws. I think it's a matter of getting more people involved, making people aware of what's out there and available to them, applying resources. Sometimes resources it's more than money. Is sometimes, especially with the non-English English language students and their parents. The students can, you know, okay, but the parents, you need resources like that to get everyone involved. So yeah, I really think definitely needs to be more of an effort there.
Just a creativity, maybe even in thinking outside of the box of how you can help people, as you said, access the tools that are out there.
Right, absolutely. And like, so a lot of people just don't have the tools or the time, or I look at it almost like voting. If you work in a restaurant, you can't get to the polls. It depends. Things are there, but you don't, the it's not, if you can't navigate, if you don't know how to navigate that process, your child is always going to be left behind. And I think that's what's happening today.
So I want to wrap up our conversation by asking you this. We're now 60 years removed from Brown. How would you define its legacy at this point?
Sticking with it, Brown's legacy is unfulfilled. People have been fighting, people have been struggling with that for years. And like you said, all these new laws that were put into place, schools are segregated again with the Neighborhood Schools Act. More white kids live in the suburbs, more black kids live in urban areas. So if you go into your urban school, if you go into your neighborhood school, your school students are going to look like you. So none of that, there's still a lot that needs to be done. And I, like I said, I just say the legacy of Brown is not fulfilled. I think things could have been done so that legacy is fulfilled. The greatest legacy was it did. It was a catalyst in the civil rights movement. It did end that horrible doctrine of separate but equal, because separate was never equal. But other than that, and like I said, it set the legal principle. So there are tools, there is a precedent, there is a starting point to get things done. And I think that's the main legacy. It ended separate but equal, and it set a precedent. People can, lawyers can fight in lower courts to get things done.
Do you have optimism that that legacy will ultimately be fulfilled?
No, I wish I did. I don't think so, but maybe because I wonder, because I go to schools now and I see they're definitely integrated, but I still say they're not segregated. I go to schools now and there's never a balance of 50% white, black, or whatever. It's not there. So I don't know if it will ever happen. If I just don't know. And I'm not really hopeful in my lifetime. It can change. It definitely can change. People are bright enough. They know what to do. They can do it. But attention spans are so, for like five less 5 minutes now, you're onto something new. So I'm not that hopeful.
You've been listening to the Delaware Humanities Podcast, A More Just Delaware, with historian, writer, and Black history educator Kathy Trusty discussing the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision Brown versus Board of Education, its links to Delaware, and the use of the courts to advance the cause of integrating schools and delivering equity in education. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. The podcast is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Delaware Humanities is a recipient of United We Stand, connecting through culture funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities to support A More Just Delaware and related programming.